Welcome to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Robert Morrison, co-author of Analytics at Work, Smarter Decisions, Better Results. On behalf of the entire Strategy Driven team, I would like to welcome you to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Robert Morrison, co-author of Analytics at Work, Smarter Decisions, Better Results. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag articles found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this special edition podcast, Robert Morrison shares with us his insights on leveraging analytics to make better business decisions that ultimately lead to superior business results. So now, without any further delays, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Robert Morrison, co-author of Analytics at Work, Smart Decisions, Better Results. Robert has led breakthrough research at the intersection of business, technology, and human asset management for the past 20 years. He has written or overseen more than 130 research and management reports on topics ranging from business reengineering to electronic business to workforce demographics. Robert is co-author of 3 Harvard Business Review articles and Workforce Crisis: How to Beat the Coming Shortage of Skills and Talent. Bob, welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and thanks for featuring the book.
I am thrilled to have you on the show. I have been involved in decision making throughout my career. Some of my work is currently used at nuclear plants around the world. So when I had a chance
where decisions really matter.
Yeah. they get a little risky at nuclear plants on some days. So I was thrilled to be able to have you on the show to talk about analytics and how they support the decision making process. So welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I'm one of these guys that is fully sold on analytics and their role in the decision-making process. But I do have a lot of clients and folks that I work with that don't always buy in right away. So I was hoping to start out with, you might be able to talk to us about the tangible benefits that you observe leaders receive from using analytics as part of their decision-making process.
Sure. To understand the benefits and really to put analytics to work, it really helps to think of it in two ways. One is using analytics, and the other is being analytical. By using analytics, what people would probably expect. You get some good data in order. You apply some statistical quantitative analysis. You maybe build some models. And you employ kind of better information and can make more fact-based decisions day in and day out in the course of doing business, mm-hmm. whether it be in a nuclear plant or somewhere else. So using analytics is all about the tools and the specific applications.
Okay.
Being analytical, though, is kind of more behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
It's how a management team should operate. And that includes kind of similar steps, but it's being attentive to the information you've got, scrutinize it a bit, explore what it means. And that exploration may involve fancy models, but it may just be in conversation with your colleagues.
Okay.
But the goal is still the same. It's to recognize patterns, correlations, notice things that are new, and then make better decisions. So you've really got to do both. Now, the value of the first is pretty clear. I mean, we've got analytics at work for us day in and day out. Just, pick your industry. When a financial services company is making a quick decision about credit or instantly detecting fraud.
Sure.
Or healthcare provider is anticipating preventing drug interactions, or you know, FedEx or somebody is optimizing the routes they take, or manufacturers optimally pricing their products. You know, it goes on and on. We're using analytics, making sort of the basic day-to-day decisions in our business processes, and saving money, making money. And that's happening all the time.
And I do see people struggle with the second, which is being analytical themselves.
Right. Well, that's going to be a lot harder to measure.
Okay.
Because when you get to, you know, what's the value of better decision-making in the management and the strategic decision-making process, where you're making, fewer, bigger decisions around tricky things like, you know, mergers and acquisitions, where decision-making is notoriously bad, if you believe the statistics. In that case, it's kind of hard to measure the value unless you can treat decision-making as a formal process and track the results, but very, very few companies do that.
Right. In fact, that was something we attempted to do within the nuclear industry, is to formalize the process so we could do better at tracking the results and evaluating the implementation of the process at various steps along the way.
Exactly. But very, very few companies, you know, go to the trouble of closing that loop. But all that said, I mean, the executive teams that we've talked to who are consciously trying to be more analytical say that what it does for them. They have more informed discussions. They have more options on the table. They have more of an appetite for experimenting a bit or innovating to decide what the answer should be. And conversely, they have less of what I call the three P's of bad decision-making: power, politics, and precedent,
Okay.
which too often rule.
Yes. And, Bob, I want to ask you about another argument that I get frequently. And these are from leaders of, I'll characterize them as small companies, even some what I would call mid-sized companies, and especially the not-for-profit organizations I work with.
We including government there, too?
I'm including government there, too.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So their argument is because there's a lack of a profit motivator or because they're small, that they just don't have the time or really the need to do analytics or use analytics as a part of their decision-making process. I was wondering if that was true, if there was certain constraints about what companies it benefited more than others, or if that, of course, was not true.
Well, there are – well, let's separate the scale question from the for-profit question.
Okay.
There are constraints on the scale of applications and the amount of data you need and use in a smaller business. Right, so
right.
You wouldn't expect them to have very elaborate models. But at the same time, I don't think there's any constraint on the benefits of using analytics. I mean, everybody needs to price their products and services, understand their customers, come up with better matches. Everybody can use analytics to test their assumptions, even when they think they know their business well. And they can use analytics in simple ways to reduce costs and improve basic operations. So I think those things apply across the board. And those are all performance goals. They don't have to be profit goals.
Sure.
Right. Now, for nonprofits, including government, I think there's just enormous potential for analytics. Because frankly, you know, those organizations tend to, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but they tend to be bureaucratic. They tend to overstandardize things.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so, you know, as a consumer of you know, especially governmental services, it just drives me nuts when you hear people say, well, we always do it this way.
Exactly.
So they don't care to analyze what they're doing or improve. Or my biggest pet peeve is they say, well, we have to treat everyone the same. And, you know, if you've got a normal bell curve distribution of cases or transactions, some are simple, some are complex, some are in between, and treating them all the same is just grotesquely inefficient.
Yes.
But with the help of a little bit of analytics, you can figure out, you know, what customer service interaction can be done quickly with no effort, and which ones require a lot of effort, and which ones are in between. So I think there's just big potential across the board, the major processes of government in particular, to use analytics to kind of shake up their methods and maybe even their attitudes.
Absolutely. In the not-for-profit case, I like to use a phrase that it's not that you're not for profit. You're a for-profit company that has no profits. And if you
or that reinvests in itself.
Exactly. And the more efficient you are, then the broader, I'll call it, client base that you can serve. And so you really are fulfilling your role in society or your role as an organization better if you can be more efficient.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And more customer attentive.
Exactly. Now, Bob, in analytics at work, you point out that decision-making is both an art and a science. And I think certainly at least a portion of analytics serves the science part of decision-making. My question was, how does a leader balance that art and science of decision-making? And maybe even more importantly, how do they recognize when they're out of balance so that they can make an appropriate adjustment?
Well, I guess there are. Glib answer is, in the book, we profile a number of analytical executives.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite profile is actually of a pair. It's the McCanns, Jim and Chris McCann, who are CEO and president, respectively, of 1-800-Flowers.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they work together, I think, kind of demonstrates the blend. I mean, Jim is the older, he's the CEO, he's the more traditional business person, more intuitive. He describes himself as, I like to get a bit of data and get on with it.
And yeah.
His younger brother, Chris, is more analytical. He's more of the school of learn all you can and then decide scientifically. But in a sense, they're both analytical because they decide things together. There's kind of a healthy tension.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're always blending, as you said, or balancing their perspectives. And they're very good at big decisions, including around things like strategic acquisitions. So I'd say what they demonstrate is it's not analytics versus your gut. As you say, a balance or a blend. It's not an either or. So you've got to always be asking yourself, what does experience say? What does the data say? And especially, can we devise some kind of experiment or test so that we can kind of bounce back and forth or look at the data against the experience against the data, and figure out what's really going on.
Okay.
I mean, they describe their culture as one of analytics and testing. And I think you always need both. You don't just use analytics and decide instantly. You very often use analytics to figure out what the next question is and what kind of experiment you want to launch.
Okay.
I don't think I answered the second half of the question, though, about the limits.
Yeah, I think when I work with clients, I look for, I guess, some key, what I call key indicators,
mm-hmm.
if I were to say they're out of balance. And some of those are, for instance, if I see management teams just not using analytics, that's an exception. I look for buzzwords. I'll have some leaders talk about experience being how you need to make all your decisions. You know, we just make decisions from the gut. And
they're playing the either-or game. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's some of those kind of key pieces. And sometimes where I see a blend of an executive team working together and you have a mix of those kind of either-or folks, then I look to see, okay, who's really got the influence in the room? Is the decision really well-balanced with various personality types and various experience bases versus, you know, some folks that might be more analytical, or is it lopsided? Are the numbers folks always winning with analytics, or are they doing so, and like you said, without any experiment to match it up with some experience? That kind of thing.
I'd just add that, maybe management teams seems maybe a little bit hokey, but maybe they should, in the middle of a big discussion, always have a checkpoint and say, are we looking at this both quantitatively and quantitatively?
Mm.
And what are we learning from each?
Mm-hmm.
Because, the really smart companies are doing both, sometimes in surprising ways. One of the companies we mentioned is eBay. This isn't a management process, it's just how they operate. But they're, they're doing nonstop experimentation with what's happening on their website.
Oh, yeah.
To test people's reactions. At the same time, they have good old-fashioned focus groups.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to people about, you know, what they want, what they like to buy, how they like to buy it, and so on. And, you know, you think you've learned something quantitatively, well, give it a qualitative test. And if you've sensed something qualitatively, give it a quantitative test.
Sure. Yeah. And that's a great example of how to achieve that balance. Yeah. Now, Bob, for leaders who are seeking to introduce or to better leverage analytics as part of their decision-making process, what kinds of questions can they expect analytics to help them answer?
Well, that's a great question because we have a framework for that. We don't. People could draw along if they like, but it's really quite simple. Yeah. You can have questions about the past, the present, or the future.
Okay.
And you can answer them with kind of straightforward information, stuff mm-hmm. you've got. So, for example, information about the past answers the question, what happened? That's just basic reporting that probably makes up, what, 90, 95% of the information generated by our automated systems these days.
Yes.
But you can also have information about the present, what's happening right now. And that usually takes the form of alerts. You know, something's happening in the manufacturing line that's out of range. Quick, pay attention to that.
Sure.
And that's based on just the most fundamental analytics of, you know, pattern recognition or setting boundaries. And there's information about the future, which is the process of extrapolating the past into the future, which is sometimes valuable, but it makes the dangerous assumption that all your major variables are remaining fairly constant.
Okay.
So there's kind of an information row of questions to ask. Mm-hmm. But if you bring in heavier analytical artillery or methods, you build a role we call insight, which is more about learning new things. So insight about the past is the question of how and why did things happen. And,
okay.
You know, with models, we learn correlations.
Mm-hmm.
Insight about the present is what's the next best action we can take? You know, how should we price the next airline seat, or what should we recommend as the next thing to buy to our customer? What's the right next best customer service action? And then finally, insight about the future is trying to answer the question, what's the best or worst that can happen given the variables we've got in play? And that, of course, requires some kind of predictive model or really as close as you can come to a simulation of the part of your business you're working in. And so what we find is, you know, in most companies, there's a whole lot of action in the information row, especially information about the past. And there's just enormous opportunity to employ analytical methods to ask the more sophisticated questions about why do things happen, what's the next best thing to do, and what's the best possible outcome.
Yeah, and that's where I think I see a lot of my clients as having a gap. You're absolutely right. They're great about looking at the past, and mm-hmm. they'll have robust reports. And they're to a large extent, not bad about the present. They'll have metrics and the things that set those alerts out.
They tend to have alerts, right.
Yeah, they tend to have alerts. But when it comes to looking at causal factors and projecting forward and looking out into the future, that's, I think, where I see most companies having some gaps. Yeah.
Indeed, and sometimes there are gaps in, they're just not employing the methods for, you know, modeling the business, looking at the future. But there's also gaps, I think, in just the basic information flow in a lot of business processes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we recommend is, you know, you look at your core processes. Chances are, a large company has gone to great trouble to map the processes and map the information flows, but perhaps not identify the decision points that really matter.
Yes.
And in any given process, you know, it's a distribution process, the decision point of choosing the truck's route or what customers and orders to put on the truck mm-hmm. is the one that typically makes or breaks the end result as far as the customer is concerned, as far as the company is concerned. And if you can just zero in on the processes, on the decision points, that really make or break the end result. Give them better information. Give them a little bit of anticipatory analytics. Let them look back upstream and understand the working assumptions when the order was placed, or downstream, if you will, and understand the customer expectations. You improve that one decision point and improve your performance across the board.
Yes.
So it's
absolutely.
Sometimes it's only a little bit of anticipation, but in the right places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, to switch subjects just a little bit, one of the things that I loved about your book was the maturity model that you presented in.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if we could just ask you to briefly describe the five stages organizations go through as they work toward achieving analytics maturity.
Oh, sure. It's my colleague Tom Davenport says that all maturity models have to have five stages. I don't know, ours does. And this is, of course, a descriptive, not a prescriptive model.
Right.
But the first stage is the starting point of having nothing in place. So we call that analytically impaired.
Okay.
The organization just has no experience or appetite for using its information in that way. Stage two we call localized analytics, and this is where most companies start. Somebody has an idea, or somebody has a little bit of background in statistical methods or something, mm-hmm. and sees a business problem and tries to address it. And this typically happens in many places at once, and so you wind up with what we call pockets of analytics, all of which may have good local effect, but you're not really able to go after bigger game in your major business processes.
Sure, they're not leveraged across the enterprise.
Exactly. So at stage three, we call analytical aspirations. That's where you start to look across the enterprise. And you recognize that it always seems to be the case that the big opportunities are at the intersections of today's boundaries.
Right? Okay.
It's the intersection of today's functions, processes, and corporations. So you start to look across and find more opportunity. And you also then start to realize you need some infrastructure in place. You need to get a little bit systematic, if you will, about where you target your analytical applications and how you go about building them. And then stage four, we call analytical companies, and that's where they've put some infrastructure in place. They've got a bit of an analytical culture. They try to use analytics day in and day out. It's kind of part of their toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, and this is what defines stage five, they're not yet analytical competitors because they're not using analytics at the heart of their value proposition or the heart of how they differentiate themselves in the marketplace.
I would imagine companies that achieve stage five, I'm thinking of what I might envision a few examples being, and I'm thinking of like eBay that you had mentioned earlier, maybe an Amazon.com type company.
They're in all industries. In fact, my co-authors, previous book, Competing on Analytics, is really profiling a lot of those companies. And we believe there's room in any industry for them.
Oh, okay.
I mean, in hospitality, Marriott has made a real science of revenue management, not just for their rooms, but all of their conference and other facilities like that.
Oh, okay.
And they stand out. Progressive Insurance has had very innovative analytical ways of not just underwriting insurance policies, but serving customers for a long time.
Okay.
And what's interesting, some of these competitors, analytics is on their calling card. They want the marketplace to know that. They want their customers to know that. Sometimes it's more behind the scenes.
Okay.
You know, someone like Netflix, a lot of their identity is their recommendation engine. What movie to get next.
Sure.
So that's part of their identity. For Marriott, you know, it's much more behind the scenes. But having a big effect on their business, a big part of how they differentiate their performance.
Okay. Oh, certainly, yeah. So we might not always see it, but it's there helping them improve.
That's right. And, but I think over time, more and more companies are going to learn that it kind of helps the brand, helps the appeal. Mm-hmm. To let sophisticated customers know that, in fact, there are some smart analytics working for them behind the scenes in your organization.
Okay. Well, Bob, delving a little deeper on the maturity model, within Analytics at Work, you had defined five key analytics components that have the acronym DELTA that goes with it, and that stands for Data, Enterprise, Leadership, Targets, and Analysts. And I know we don't have time to go into the maturity model for each of those five different components. But I was wondering if you might be able to tell us a little bit about what each of the five DELTA components is.
Sure. The first, larger half, if that's possible, book has a chapter on each of those five. The maturity model I just mentioned, the five stages, is about kind of the typical progression companies go through as they build their analytical capability. Mm-hmm. The delta is about five things you have to have in place for any given application, project, initiative to succeed. So think of it as kind of more local. Okay. And so the first thing you need in place is D for delta, and or D for data, and that's, you know, data is the foundation of analytics. You want good data, you want it to be complete, accurate. But what we find is, as anyone who does market research knows, you don't always have to have complete data or completely accurate data. Sometimes the more interesting question is the data sufficient for our analytical purpose of learning and making a decision? So okay. We'd say instead of the normal questions about complete accurate, and sometimes don't even get fixated on those.
Yes.
Ask, is the data sufficient? Can you combine it with other interesting data that your mm-hmm. customers or partners have? And is the result some unique data that you can analyze and exploit? So we try to open people's eyes to a bigger range of data questions.
Okay.
Enterprise is a little tricky, but we've touched upon it. As companies reach that stage three in particular, when they're getting some analytical aspirations, they find they've got lots of opportunities, but of course you can't address them all. And the ones you do want to address tend to be cross-functional.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the only way to resolve that riddle is to take more of an enterprise view.
Okay.
And say, we may be focusing on marketing analytics right now, but we have to understand that's our priority versus other possibilities. And we have to start thinking about getting the right tools and databases and so on in place and channel our resources and maybe think ahead to what we're going to do after marketing analytics.
Okay.
So the enterprise perspective really, really helps steer your course. Mm-hmm. The L of delta is leadership, and that's leadership at the enterprise level, but especially at the level of the given initiative. And as you might expect, you want the leaders to support, embrace, bless the analytics effort, but also themselves to set an example by being analytical, by following along closely. We make the point they really need to sign on for the results of the initiative, mm-hmm. not for doing analytics.
Okay, sure. Oh, certainly. Yeah.
And then T is targets. It's what's the specific thing we're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And a good target is as specific and measurable as possible, as in other areas, something that makes a difference for the business, can be measured, is supported. It may be a stretch, but it's also feasible.
Okay.
And the one just as a sideline, as you're looking for targets, of course, you can be analytical and systematic. You can, do one of the exercises to decompose your value chain. You can look at your decision points, as I suggested earlier. What we found was sometimes the genesis of an idea for a good target actually comes from the gut.
Okay.
It's a hunch that a very experienced person, often a senior executive, has about how the business can just be better. And we've met people like these in our work lives all the time. It's the guy who's on a hobby horse. I know we can fill an order in a day if we just do it right. Everybody else, no, never happen. That's not how we work around here. There's got to be a way. And the person with a hunch sometimes has the both the drive and the insight
mm-hmm.
to target your analytics. Now, of course, you don't just build something for the hunch. You get analytical about the hunch. You do a test. You do a pilot. And then maybe build a model that enables you to fill an order in a day.
Okay. Sure.
And then finally, A is for analysts. Mm-hmm. And here, if you're thinking in terms of a specific analytical initiative, you're focused on the people who can do the math, build the models, and so on. But if you're thinking about building your overall analytical capability over time, we recommend thinking about three categories. One is the professionals I just mentioned. These people are otherworldly. They have like PhDs in statistics and computer science and operations research sometimes. But a second category is what we call the semi-professionals. And those are, think of them as business analysts who have a good quantitative-qualitative balance
mm-hmm.
and are able to sometimes provide some measure of translation services from what the business does, what it needs, what its opportunities are, to the work of the professionals. And then the third category, we call them analytical amateurs, and it's not to be pejorative. You know, the CEO, with any luck, is an analytical amateur.
Sure.
They're people who are using the results of formal analytics day in and day out to do a better job in the business. So you need data enterprise leadership targets and analysts come together in the right measure to succeed with any given initiative.
Okay. Now, pulling all of that together, at the very end of your book, you lay out a roadmap that organizations can take on this journey to becoming more analytical. If you were to, say, pick just the most significant factor on creating an organization that leverages and values analytics, what might that be?
Well, for building the organization, I think the biggest factor is leaders.
Okay.
Is leadership and the example they set. I mean, our hero is W. Edwards Deming, the father of the total quality movement, who famously said, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." and if you really, and actually if people quote that back to us all the time, to where the origin is kind of vague, but it's a catchphrase that executives can adopt. And in fact, should probably be adopted in a lot of executive team meetings and even boardroom discussions. If you take that attitude, you set the tone for a more informed management decision-making process. And leaders, you know, they also create the culture through what we call pushbacks and pats on the back. The leader's example makes it okay for people to push back one to another, saying, for example, where'd you get that data? Is it up to date? Mm-hmm. What are the hypotheses or assumptions behind it? What alternatives did you consider? Where did you come up with that recommendation? Of course, you want the discourse to be polite, but you've got to be able to push back in order to be analytical and gain the benefits. And then, of course, pats on the back is recognizing and rewarding people who are, in fact, analytical.
Yeah.
So the leader sets the tone, creates the culture, and the more I think about it, the leader has to exhibit the most, I think it's sometimes the most important analytical behavior, which is to just relentlessly review what your business is about.
Yes.
Its assumptions, its models, it's what, of course, Wall Street executives failed to do in the subprime mortgage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really second-guess yourself, but just relentlessly review what's going on and make sure your assumptions are up to date. Make sure you're in touch with your marketplace. And if the CEO and other leaders are always probing that way, then you're going to have a more robust and more analytically inclined strategy process.
Yeah. I always say that it's the leader's role to ask the needed question at the
appropriate
time.
And demand the data.
Absolutely.
Behind the answers.
I was going to say, I also typically say that the numbers don't lie. We may push them around to try to make them say something that we want them to say, but...
Well, they don't always tell the whole story, but it's hard for them to lie.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Bob, before we close, you have a website, and it's www.analyticsatworkbook.com that provides an abundance of additional resources in support of leveraging analytics in the workplace. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your website and the resources our listeners can find there.
Oh, sure. Well, the website, as you just mentioned, features the book and the three co-authors, Tom Davenport, Jeannie Harris, and yours truly. And it's very graciously hosted by Accenture, for whom Jeannie works. And so in addition to what you'd expect regarding information about the book, the authors, some feedback from executives who've read the book, and some additional research available, of course, the opportunity to order it. So all of those expected things. There's also a column, of course, with links to various Accenture products and services associated with analytics.
Okay, great. And I've been
to the website. It's very straightforward, very simple to navigate. Yeah.
It's a great website because I've been there and have gone around. In fact, we're going to put a link in the article with that goes with the podcast, so that our listeners can just, with a single click, get right to it.
Oh, excellent.
Have all that great access to the great materials that are there. So, well, Bob, I want to thank you, not just for your time, but for sharing your insights on the value of analytics to the decision-making process and to an overall business success. I really enjoyed analytics at work, in particular for the roadmap that you provided and the fact that it had a maturity curve so that an organization's leaders can measure their progress as they transition to becoming a more analytical organization and using analytics to help them in their decision-making processes. So I hope our readers will pick up a copy of Analytics at Work and then use it as a guide to help their organization to become more analytical in their decision-making process. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. And let me just conclude with my typical blessing, which is may all your analytics be good and your judgment even better.
Outstanding. I like it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I would like to personally thank Robert Morrison for being with us today and sharing his insights on how to better leverage analytics to improve decision-making and turbocharge results. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. You can find more information about Robert Morrison and Analytics at Work at www.analyticsatworkbook.com. Until next time, so long.